part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana. On Tuesday, November 16th, the Corkscrew will host a five-course wine dinner in the Tuscan Room at Timponi's Ristorante, featuring the foods and wines of Italy's Piedmont region. Tickets available at the Corkscrew. Information at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. For a time in the 19th century, she was one of the most famous women in the world. She was a woman of the Victorian age, a woman of the British upper middle class who traveled to the Crimea at the height of the war to nurse the wounded. She saved thousands of lives. She was a pioneer in public health, of course. Her name, Florence Nightingale. This afternoon, we'll get a glimpse of this remarkable woman's life and times. Florence Nightingale was born in 1820. She died in 1910. Our guest today is Gillian Gill. She is the author of Nightingales, The Extraordinary Upbringing and Curious Life of Miss Florence Nightingale. Gill says of this book, it is not a biography of Florence Nightingale. It is instead, in Gill's words, the story of an influential, functioning, evolving family unit and how it held strong to meet the challenges of its day. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, anywhere in the U.S., if you're listening on the Internet, you can give us a call on our toll-free line, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest, Gillian Gill. She holds a PhD in modern French literature from Cambridge. She has taught at Northeastern, Wellesley, Yale, and Harvard. She is the author of Agatha Christie, The Woman and Her Mysteries, and Mary Baker Eddy. Her latest book, Nightingales, is published by Ballantine Books. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Dr. Gill, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
I am so happy to be here.
This book, as I mentioned in the introduction and as you say at the outset of Nightingales, is not a biography of Florence Nightingale, but of a clan and of an age. When you embarked on this project, was that your plan?
Not really. I had hoped to do a complete biography of Florence Nightingale, but it became apparent to me very quickly that this was sort of a lifetime endeavor. And maybe I didn't have a complete lifetime to devote to one person. And so Florence Nightingale hasn't had what I would say a full-scale biography since 1950. Barbara Dossey, who is a wonderful nurse, holistic nurse, and scholar of nursing profession, has done a more recent book, but she didn't really get into archival sources. I think she was much more concerned with the public health nursing angle of Nightingale's life. So I decided that since I couldn't do everything, what I would like to do was to look at her roots, Nightingale's roots, to look at her familial support, and really think in some detail about what she owed to her parents, to her grandparents, to the social class that she belonged to the religious faith that she so fervently espoused, sort of to put her in context, to see her as indeed a most extraordinary, remarkable, achieving woman who nonetheless doesn't in some sense stand alone, who comes out of something, who owes a great deal to other people. So there's the roots angle, and there's the whole question of how someone who as you may know, Florence Nightingale, after she came back from the Crimea within 18 months, had relapsed into invalidism, which lasted for a good 15 years. And then after that, she was a sort of semi-invalid for the rest of her very long life. She was 90 when she died. So during this period, she was working feverishly, fervently, in public health, in nursing, in what they called then sanitarian design of hospitals, thinking about army camps in India, all kinds of public health projects, not just in Britain, but in the then British Empire. So the question came up suddenly in my mind, how can one do this if one is a single lady living in one's bedroom? And the answer is, of course, you have tremendous familial support. And so this was sort of the end of the thing that I looked at, Florence Nightingale and her family. I pointed out that all of this work, which of course was done in isolation, was done tremendously by her own hands, her own eyes, her own brain, nonetheless would have been impossible if she hadn't had a remarkably intelligent, sympathetic support network behind her. And that was largely, I mean, there were a great number of professional colleagues, but the real, you know, the money to buy the house, the money to buy the food, the servants, etc., which made invalidism possible for her, this came from her father, it came from her family, and the personal service that she got from her aunt, from her cousin, and, you know, from those members of her family who rallied around for, you know, 57 mm-hmm. years of invalidism. That's a pretty remarkable piece of familial support, I think. And that was a story I wanted to tell.
Yeah. You tell readers at the outset that Florence Nightingale is one of the best documented women who has ever lived. Her papers are voluminous. She wanted it known, you say, just how hard it was to be Florence Nightingale.
Right.
But you note here it wasn't easy being her mother, father, aunt, cousin, friend, or sister. How did this family hold together? Florence Nightingale could be a very difficult woman.
She was a very difficult woman. I think they were all difficult in their ways. And I think those of us who have good, strong families know this balance. That's to say, you have intelligent, sensitive, outgoing, energetic people, and they love each other very much, but they also don't get on always with each other. They have different views of life, different plans for the future, different projects upon which they're intent. Well, the Nightingale family was this in you know, multiplied several times. So, you know, she was a difficult woman. Her mother was a difficult woman. Her father had his problems. Her sister was very, very difficult. So all in all, this made for a concoction. But underneath it all was this loyalty, this agreement on basic values, agreement on basic principles, and a willingness to work. This is a very important. You know, they were all energetic. They all did a great deal in their lives. And so putting this together, you have a recipe for achievement, but always, you know, as I say, pulling against one another in different directions. And Nightingale herself, you started in on this section of our discussion with the discussion of the papers, where she was a sort of a pack rat. You know, she started writing when she was six, and her family kept everything she wrote because she was so remarkable as a little girl that somehow a family that liked to collect its own papers in general especially collected hers. And so we have, you know, letters that she wrote when she was five, a little drawing that she wrote when she did when she was five, showing herself having a quarrel with her sister and being reconciled and being good. You know, we have an extraordinary database on her, but most of it is written by her. And so we have one person's view of a very complicated family situation. The others, of course, did write letters, so we have some of their letters, but we don't have anything like the amount of information on them. And so what we've had in Florence Nightingale biography is Florence's view of the Nightingale's life. And of course, she is the most achieving. She is the most important. She is the most remarkable. And she knew it, and they knew it. But still, you know, she had a gigantic beef against her family. She had to complain about them. And one also has to realize that she used, I mean, nowadays, perhaps, person like her might go, you know, to a counselor or a psychoanalyst or simply talk to friends intensively about problems. But on the whole, what she did was to confide it to the paper. She wrote it down in private notes, in journals, etc. Now, this is where if you write your journal, you sort of feel that you can say exactly what's in your mind. But, of course, this is the record that's come down to us because she kept it. She kept an enormous amount of her private papers. And so we get her most intense resentments put on the paper, resentments that probably she didn't express in real life. But she was able to confide to the blank sheet. And yet, at the same time, because she had this sense of legacy from a very early age, she kind of knew in a weird way that she was going to be important. This in itself, I think, from the point of view of women's biography, is very interesting and very rare. This is a woman who sort of figured that she ought to be famous, had what it took to be famous from a very young age, and so kept all her papers. And so she's writing it down. She is giving it to us as a legacy. She's saying, this is my life. I want to control it even beyond the grave. I'm going to tell you how it felt to be me. So in some sense, I'm working against the papers by saying, hey, okay, this is just her view. Let's look a little bit at how it must have seemed to the other people.
Yeah. You know, I think this is very useful in biography, though, because for the biographer, it's got to be difficult to interpret.
Yes.
And so here you have a way to provide some context and perspective on a person's life.
I hope so. When it's all, you know, interpretation is both essential and inevitable and dangerous. And in some ways with Nightingale, as I said, you know, there's an enormous volume of information on her all through her life. And so in some ways, here we have too much almost information, but it's coming from a single source. And so there's a powerful story being told by the person herself. She is building a myth herself during life. We have to recognize that myth, but also maybe take a step back and say, you know, there are other stories to be told a little bit, and maybe the central story becomes more interesting if it's counterposed against the other stories.
Yeah, and also the story of the time is very interesting as well.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that. You open the story with a Nightingale household in crisis.
Right.
Florence has just turned down a proposal of marriage. Why did Florence's parents and sister see this as such a crisis?
Well, as I try to explain, the whole question of Florence Nightingale's marriage is a very, very interesting one because her family was part of a religious tradition that was essentially Unitarian, though they had, as it were, converted to the Church of England by the time Florence is a little girl. It's essentially Unitarian tradition, and within that tradition, interestingly, girls did not get married when they were 17 and 18 or even 20. They tended to get married in their late 20s. However, Florence gets to her late 20s, and she's still not married. And in her family, there was an interesting financial difficulty. That is to say that her father had inherited an estate from a great uncle, his mother's uncle. And this estate was what was called entailed. That is to say, he did not have control of it once his life was over. He could not will it to anyone he liked. It would go inevitably on his death to his son, if he had a son. If not, it would pass to his sister, and thereto to her son, if she had a son. And his sister, as it turned out, did have a son, and he did inherit the Nightingale estate when Mr. Nightingale finally passed away in 1872. And so Mr. and Mrs. Nightingale, Florence's parents, have two daughters. They have no more children. And so there is the constant cloud hanging over this family that should the father die, the family loses a large chunk of their income. And notably, they lose the two very beautiful and beloved family homes, one in Derbyshire and one in Hampshire. And so the Mr. and Mrs. Nightingale have, even though they're very financially well off during Mr. Nightingale's life, and he's a very provident money manager, if he sort of goes off and falls on his head from his horse, or if he you know, mm-hmm. happens to pick up cholera in London when he's down there, which is something that happens all the time to people, you understand, in the 19th century. The sudden death is key part of life in this culture. If that happens, the family is certainly not destitute, but they're much, much reduced in social status as well as in money. And so Mrs. Nightingale's concern is that since her elder daughter doesn't seem to either want or be able to find a suitable husband, how nice it would be if her second daughter, Florence, were married, had a comfortable home, were set in society, and were able to bring forward the family by a successful marriage. And so there is a strong, strong urge to get Florence married to the right kind of man. And when the right man came along, desperately wanted to marry her, or so it seemed, made several proposals, she seems to like him enormously, mm-hmm. And yet persists in refusing him. Unsurprisingly, her family are distraught.
Oh. Have you found yourself imagining what Florence Nightingale's life would have been had she married, and had she married, Richard Monckton Milnes?
Oh, you know, I did. And this was so extraordinary. This is something that, perhaps unsurprisingly, the earlier biographers of Nightingale have left completely unexamined. Richard Monckton Milnes, who is the man that Florence herself says in a little autobiographical fragment, the only man that I was tempted to marry. She says she almost married him. And I discovered when I started researching this man that this sort of pillar of, apparent pillar of British society, I shouldn't say apparent, he was a pillar of British political and literary society, had in his private life been pretty clearly a very, very homosexual person. That's to say, flamboyantly, almost stereotypically gay in his self-presentation, in his way of life, and had from even in the period when he was courting Florence, had begun, he didn't have much money when he was courting Florence, which is one reason, of course, why he was courting her. He had started a collection of sadomasochistic paraphernalia to do with, you know, crime and punishment, you know, skins of people who'd been flayed, you know, in order to kill them. He had the skin of a criminal person. He had ropes that had been used to he had documentation about horribly sadistic practices in various cultures. And this worked gradually into his becoming, when, as I say, he finally begins to have some money, into his becoming the major English collection of the works of the Marquis de Sade. And he is sort of notorious in gay literature, or famous, whichever way you, of introducing the poet Algernon Swinburne at the age of about 19 to the texts of the Marquis de Sade, which Richard Monckton Milnes possessed both in published forms and, in certain cases, in actual autographs. That's to say, he had the written manuscripts of Sade. So the idea that Florence Nightingale, who was chaste, pure, dedicated to the celibate life, wishing to become for, you know, perhaps 10 years of her life, a member of a Roman Catholic nursing order, the idea that this woman might, in a sort of, as it were, moment of weakness, have accepted this man whom her family was so very, very anxious that she should marry, and who seemed to be the answer to so many of her problems, that she might have married him and found herself not just sitting next to this person in real life, lying next to this person, producing his children, but also in some ways financing this kind of interest that he had.
Hmm.
Don't you find that just grotesque?
Yes, it was chilling. But at the same time, I put down the book and I went and told my husband all about it. It was, oh my God, do you know who Florence Nightingale almost married?
Yes.
Yes.
So I think while I'm saying this, you know, Richard Monckton Milnes really was a pillar of Victorian society. He was a wonderful brother. He was a wonderful son, both to both parents. He was a good husband. He was a good father. He was a good MP, Member of Parliament. He was on the right side. He wrote a biography of the poet Keats, which rescued Keats and sort of launched him into the kind of fame that John Keats now has in British literary tradition. He espoused in Britain the work of Walt Whitman. He was, in many ways, a pillar of enlightenment. He was a nice man. He just happened to be, you know, a sadomasochistic homosexual. those two were parts of his character. She only knew one side of him.
Yeah. Well, let's go on and talk about get into some more information here about this time in history. This was interesting. At the early in the book, you tell us the most bitter and divisive social crusade of the 19th century was for equal legal and political rights, financial independence, and personal liberty for women, and the battleground was not so much Parliament or the law courts as individual homes throughout the land. Other than the issue of marriage for Florence and her sister, Parthenope, how did this struggle play out in the Nightingale household?
Well, their family for, I think, three generations had been dedicated to liberal and even radical causes, notably the abolition of slavery, but also things like the independence of Poland and of Italy, which in those days was a big question. They had been involved in the animal rights movement. They were, of course, coming from Unitarian, they were sort of foundational members of the Unitarian Church in Britain. And this was a very persecuted sect and had tremendous legal barriers against them. And so they were for trying to break down the laws that differentiated between the treatment of the Church of England members and all other religious. So, you know, religious freedom was a huge thing for them. So all of these things are in part of their culture. And this leads almost inevitably into women's rights. I mean, Mary Wollstonecraft was a good friend. Well, was certainly known to Florence's grandfather, her maternal grandfather. So there's a strong radical frame, political and philanthropic religious strain in the family. The question is, how do women and men within the family carry that forward? And so what I found in her background are her two of her mother's sisters, so Florence's aunties, mm-hmm. were both, you know, radical feminists. I mean, one can actually say this. They were proto-feminists. They, you know, they worked all their lives for women's education. They worked for the vote, even, for, you know, the Married Women Property Act, which enabled married women to keep their inherited or earned income and have rights to, you know, keep their children in cases of divorce and separation. So Florence is part of that. The question is, what can women do as opposed to what can men do? And even in this very radical family, the feeling was that essentially it was the men's job to carry this forward, that the women's job was, in some important sense, to have the children, to bring forth family life, and that a woman's first Christian duty and even her national duty was to marry, be a good wife, be a good mother, and if then she had spare time, she could take up some kind of philanthropic work. But it would be on the side of her life. This is what Florence Nightingale would not accept. She would not accept that what she viewed as a direct mission from God to work in what we would now call the healthcare field. She would not agree that that would be done in the margins of her life. She wanted to devote herself absolutely full time to it. And so whereas her family would have wanted, desired her to marry a man of similar radical views, such as Richard Monckton Mills, who would be on the liberal side of the spectrum, working for reform, working for enlightenment, as they saw it, they would have wanted her to be at the side of such a man, helping him. but always in the private sphere, and then perhaps doing what you might call Lady Bountiful type work, you know, taking bowls of soup and sort of little knitted garments. I'm being a little facetious, but you understand what I mean, to the poor people in the community where they lived. She just did not want that. She wanted to dedicate herself full-time, and that was the problem that her parents could not see and did not think it was right that she should do that.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Jillian Gill. She is the author of Nightingales, The Extraordinary Upbringing and Curious Life of Miss Florence Nightingale. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-9455. W-I-L-L. Well, when Florence was a young woman, 17 years of age, in 1837, she feels a call.
Yes.
And this is, and here we have mysticism entering the picture, but this would have been something that would have been foreign to Florence Nightingale and her family, correct?
Well, this is as I interpret it. You know, Florence Nightingale actually refers a number of times in her life to St. Teresa of Avila. She actually translated a number of mystic texts. But what is clear is that within the double religious tradition in which she was raised, that being the Unitarian or Rationalist Christian or Socinian, as they were called in the 18th, 19th century, so the Unitarian and then the Church of England tradition, which is in a certain way social, conventional, traditional, conservative. I'm making gross generalizations here, but you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. But certainly not mystic, whereas St. Teresa in her generation, the idea of receiving a message directly from God would have been something that people in her community would have in some ways readily accepted. They might not have agreed that you actually had received them. I mean, St. Teresa had problems having people recognize that it wasn't the devil speaking to her, you know? But they knew that the devil spoke and that God spoke to people, and that was part of their tradition. But in the English community where the young Florence Nightingale was being brought up, that was really not considered part of, you know, what sort of nice upper middle class English people had. You sort of didn't hear voices. This was kind of, you know, Joan of Arc was a peasant. she wasn't a nice Victorian young lady. So as far as I can tell, Florence's mentions this experience, and she says she had at least two other occasions in her early life, again, before she went to the Crimea in 54, when she hears the voice of God. She tells us this, but this is in notes that she made late in life, coming after she comes back from the Crimea in 56. So she's recording something that she remembers, which changed her life, which gave her the strength to resist the familial and social pressures that she is receiving to marry, etc., and lead a conventional life. She is, you know, attributing, as it were, her life to this call, and yet there is no record of it when she is 17. And there's no record that she told anyone about it. My sense is that probably she didn't, that she held it in her heart. But that this was at the core of her determination, and this is it was the sense that God had chosen her that enabled her to say no to her mother, no to her sister, no to society.
It opens the door for her.
Yes.
Let's talk with a listener. A caller in Urbana is waiting to talk with us on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm wondering if there's any evidence that you found that Florence was lesbian.
Ah. Interesting. Yes, I do deal with that in my book, and I invite you to read my very carefully considered section on this. She was not a lesbian in the sense that she engaged in sexual practices with women. That is absolutely clear. And we would, since she is so well documented, and since so much was written about her, we would, I think, for sure know. I think she never had any sexual experience with either men or women. What is clear, however, is that she had profound, and what she herself uses the word, passionate feelings for women. This began in her teenage years when she had a cousin who was apparently a most remarkable young woman. And Florence says that, you know, she has passionate feelings for this cousin, and when the cousin turned on her, that she fell into a kind of despair, and that it almost made her feel that she should never love anyone quite that way again, and it's possible that she never did. Yeah. But, as I say, to call her a lesbian is simply wrong, and certainly to assert that she had any kind of suspect relationships with either men or women is absolutely incorrect, even though I hear that in certain nursing schools, this is a legend that has passed down. You know, Florence Nightingale was a invalid for many, many years, and there have been an enormous amount of discussion as to what was wrong with her. Well, one of the suggestions is that, horribly, that she was suffering from venereal disease, perhaps syphilis, which has all kinds of strange neurological implications for the person. Well, this is horrible, horrible, corrupt thinking about her. You know, you can accuse her of being a nasty, bitchy old maid who doesn't understand sexuality. You can't accuse her of being corrupt and sexually promiscuous in any way. That is simply not true. But she loved women with passion. She loved some men with passion. She resisted the passion in her life. I think that's the truth of it. And, you know, that she should have felt obliged to do so, I think, is a horrible indictment of the Victorian view of sexuality and of women's role. I mean, hers is a tragic life from this point of view, I feel.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question. Others are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Florence Nightingale was a strange woman who came from a strangish family. Maybe curious would be the way to say it. That's the word you put in the subtitle to the book. But you note in the early going that to be odd was to be typically Victorian. And she was a funny little girl who grew into an intimidating young woman. That's how you put it. And then, as we mentioned, she took to her bed for 20 years. She had been waiting for death for decades, but she lived until the age of 90. How was she typically Victorian? How was she untypical in this respect?
I have to say I'm not an expert on the Victorian period in a certain way, but you know, in my researches, my previous biography was of Mary Baker Eddy, the founder of Christian Science. And so I've looked, and her dates correspond almost exactly to Florence Nightingale's life. Mrs. Eddy was born 1 year after Florence Nightingale and died in the same year. So when I looked at this period, both in America and in Great Britain, what strikes me is how odd people were. You know, when I was growing up, Victorians were considered to be sort of conventional and sort of respectable and boring. And what I've found as I've ventured into this Victorian period is, on the contrary, how strange and complicated and confused and confusing they were, and rich in all kinds of political, sexual, psychological, emotional, familial activities. So, you know, Florence Nightingale has this extraordinary career of, as I say, 57 years in virtual invalidism. And when I looked at other lives, you think, boy, you know, they were pretty strange people. I mean, think of Emily Bronte. I mean, of course, she dies when she's only, 27? The life of the Brontes has received a great deal of attention, but in some ways they weren't untypical. The isolation, the bitterness, the dying of a mother, a father, the poverty, the lack of any kind of social security. That is to say that, you know, if your father dies and there is no money, you can fall right to the bottom of society. And, of course, the whole structures of sexual hierarchy in Victorian times, which made it so extraordinarily difficult for Victorian women of any class to make a living if they were deprived of a father's or a husband's support. All those things made me realize that, you know, Florence was weird, but boy, you know, she wasn't unusually weird in the same sense. Maybe I'm overestimating this, but, you know, you look at Tennyson's life, you look at Coleridge's life, even Wordsworth's life, they all have very, very, very strange careers, and the politicians are almost worse. So, again, to return to Richard Monckton Mills, again, he's not unusually Victorian in having this extreme double existence. It's a wonderful, rich, strange period to be working in.
Let's talk with another listener, caller in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hello. I'm looking forward to buying the author's book, and I wanted her to repeat the title again and give her a little bit of my background. I'm a senior citizen now, but I graduated from St. Luke's in St. Louis over 50 years ago, and Florence Nightingale was our idol. In fact, it was the oldest school west of the Mississippi, and it closed. It was a three-year program, and it closed several years ago, much to our sorrow. But anyway, we had to go to chapel every morning. It was an Episcopal school, and I thought at capping 6 months after we entered, and then at graduation in the Episcopal Cathedral, we repeated the Florence Nightingale pledge, but unfortunately I have forgotten all of that. And then when I pursued a degree several years later, I went to Navy Pier, which was then the University of Illinois, and then I transferred to Elmhurst College for my degree because I would have to come downstate. But both places I wrote papers and received an A on, about Florence Nightingale. And I think I mostly, I was very happy that I got an A on both of them at both places, but I thought I pursued mostly the Crimean War experience. But I am really interested in her family and want to revive my memory. So I wondered if you would repeat again the name of your book.
The name of the book is essentially Nightingales. I'm going to have to read this to be sure I get it right. The Extraordinary Experience and Curious Life of Miss Florence Nightingale. Uh-huh. But, as I say, the essential title is Nightingales with an S.
Thank you.
And the author's name is, her last name is Gill, G-I-L-L.
G-I-L-L. Thank you so much. I'm really enjoying the discussion. Brings back many memories, and I'm ashamed to admit that having worked very hard on those two essays, I can't quite remember the details.
I think that's quite okay.
I think so, too.
But Florence Nightingale was our idol, and you know, we wore those old-fashioned uniforms with the white,
the little caps,
aprons, and the blue-checked blouses. And we had a cap that had three points on it that stood for hand, heart, and oh, what's the other one? Anyway, everything was in the vein of being a Florence Nightingale. So I'm really looking forward to reading your book. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. You know, the caller mentioned the Crimean War. Well, maybe we should talk about that and her experience there among her achievements. This contributed to the achievements that she made through her life was her contributions to nursing.
Well, I think that this is, again, something I hadn't fully understood. That Florence Nightingale's greatest achievements came after the Crimean War, but in some sense they were enabled by what she did during the Crimean War. I mean, she was able to become a force in public health in Britain and in the then British Empire. She was able to become a force in nursing because she had won international fame through her work for 21 months during the Crimean War, 1854 to 1856. The Crimean War was one of those stupid wars that, you know, didn't really achieve anything much, in which many men died. And perhaps two key factors about this war made it different from others. First was that in Britain they had a modern free press, which was enabled by the recent invention of the telegraph to send news from the battleground within days back home. And so you had reporters, notably the great Times of London reporter William Russell, who was an Irishman, incidentally, living with the soldiers on the Crimean Peninsula and reporting back. And his reports would appear within days, often before the government had heard what had happened through their couriers. The newspapers would be telling the British public. And so the British public is following the war and looking. I mean, it had been profoundly in favor of the war. The war went rapidly, very badly, and men were dying, not from wounds so much as from disease. And then the question was, how were they being treated, and why had they been allowed to fall sick in the first place? So this is when the British government, in the person of Sidney Herbert, asks Florence Nightingale to go out and take a little party of nurses, to bring sort of womanly sympathy and compassion to the wards out there. And the British government doesn't really know what they're doing. They don't. I mean, of course they know that Nightingale is competent to do this. They trust her to do a good job, but the job they anticipate is not the job she does, because what she sees is suddenly a woman goes out to a war zone with a certain amount of authority, not much, but a certain amount, more than any other woman had ever done before. And this is an educated woman who is not intimidated by the officers and the lords and the medical authorities of the day, who is willing to stand up for them and say, there are men dying here who do not need to die. I am going to do what I can to save them. And I don't care what you say. And she has, because, as I said, her friend Sidney Herbert is back at the War Office, she has a direct conduit to the upper region, you know, the top, the Prime Minister, the Cabinet, and even to the Queen, Queen Victoria and Prince Albert. She writes, and she knows all of this information that she's sending directly to London, that this is going to get through. And so through her, the reform process of the way that the army is provisioned, the army is fed, the army is clothed, and the army is cared for when soldiers fall sick, these are all subjected to analysis, to informed solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And she moves the reform process forward. And at the same time, of course, she is being a nurse. She is actually spending time on patient care. She is in the fore. I mean, she is the woman who is working harder than any other woman out there to do what she can for individual soldiers, both those who can be helped to live and those who are dying. She is a force of good, and she wins this reputation, not with the officer class, which is, in a sense, her social class, you understand, but with the average soldier, the man who has been regarded hitherto as a brute, an animal, someone who can't be expected to reason, who doesn't need to be cared for any more than a horse, and perhaps less than a horse in a certain way, because horses were, after all, valuable and sold on the market. So she says, I am their champion. I care about them. I am their mother. She considers it a very maternal relationship. And she sets out to try and make it better for them. When she comes back, she directs the rest of her energies. She spends the rest of her life working, not, as I say, for the privileged officer class, not for her own class, but for the ordinary person who is whose life is, shortened or prolonged by public health measures, by social services, by hospital regulations. All of these sort of detailed and annoying and practical things. And she brings to those things a religious zeal. Mm. And it goes through, as I say, for the next 50 years, one can say, after she returns from the Crimea.
We have to wrap up here. I'm sorry to say, there's so much more I would like to talk with you about. It seems to me she had a big heart. She had tremendous compassion for fellow human beings. She had keen powers of observation and analysis. But, you know, I think if I was ill and in her hands, I would love her. I would like her very much.
You would.
But when I had recovered, I might not like her quite so well because she could be so very difficult. And I wonder if we could just finish up here by, I'd like to know, how do you feel about her?
She was a difficult woman. She cared more about mankind in general than she did about individual people. Mm. I trace this back to her flawed relationship with her mother in childhood. Maybe that is just my interpretation. It's open to doubt. But this is how I see it. She had a difficulty with intimacy, but she also had, from tiny girlhood, a sense of empathy for people who people of her class tended to see as part of the landscape. Mm. She felt their pain. Now, it's true that when she had dealt with them on, massaged their feet and helped their bed sores, she moved on to the next one. She didn't think of them as individuals. That was always hurtful. But we need people like that in our world.
Yeah. We have to leave it there. Gillian Gill, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
This has been a great pleasure.
Gillian Gill is the author of Nightingales, The Extraordinary Upbringing and Curious Life of Miss Florence Nightingale. The book is published by Ballantine Books. 7 minutes before 2 o'clock, and settlement prices should be in now from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade this afternoon, futures in the bean pit finished 3 cents lower in the November contract. The Dease corn was off a penny and a half, and the nearby December wheat was 2 1/4 higher. We'll take a look at complete look at those corn and bean numbers in a moment, but we'll stay with the December wheat to begin with. 309 1/4 the high this afternoon. The low at 303 and a half at a settlement price for the day at 308 3/4 in the wheat pit at the Board of Trade, 2 1/4 higher. March contract at 322 1/2 high, low at 316 1/2. They settled at 322, were up 2 1/2 cents, and the May futures up 2 cents today. 228 1/2 the high, the low 223 3/4. May wheat settled 2 cents higher at 327. July futures in the wheat pit, 335 the high, the low at 29, and a settlement price at 334. They were up 3 1/2 cents in the September for next year, a penny and a half higher at 339 today, with a high of 340 and a low at 336. From the corn pit, the nearby December at the Board of Trade settled the day at 198. They were off a penny and a half today, with a high of 99 1/4 and a low at 97 1/2. March corn, 210 3/4 the high, the low at 209 1/2. Settlement price at 210 1/4, down 1 1/2. And the May futures, 218 1/4 high, low at 217, settled 217 1/2. They were off 1 1/2 cents today. July futures in the corn pit, 224 1/2 the high, the low at 223 1/2. Settlement price there, 224, penny and a half lower. And the September contract down 1 1/2 as well. 232 1/2 the high, the low 231 3/4, settled on that low. Once again, the September off 1 1/2 cents. December futures for next year, 241 1/2 the high, the low at 240 1/2. Settlement price at 241 even. They were a penny and a quarter lower on the day. December oats, 142 1/4 high, low at 139 3/4, settled 140 1/4, off 1/4 cent. And the March at 148 1/2 high, low at 146 1/4. The settlement price there at 146 1/2. They finished down 1. From the soy complex, Nearby November beans, the biggest loser of the day, although they were only down 3 cents, had a high today of 508, pushed up to that area, and then dropped back down to a low of 501, settled a penny above that at 502. Once again, that November bean contract was down 3 cents. Most of the trade thinking that this had to do a little bit with the Chinese sales that keep being pushed back even further. They were set for November, and then there was talk that they were going to happen in December. And now there's some talk that the Chinese don't want these beans until January. So the nearby November off 3 cents today. We'll talk about that, by the way, with Pete Manhartz, who will be in during the closing mark report at 6 after the next hour. He's filling in today, of course, for our regular Monday analyst, Kurt Kimmel. 5.11, the high today in the January contract for the bean pit, the low at 5.03, settlement price at 5.05.5. They were up a quarter of a cent in the March futures. 5.17.5 high, low at 5.10, settlement price 5.11.75. They were down a quarter of a cent. In the May contract, 5.24.25 high, low at 5.16.5, settled 5.18.25, down 1. July futures for the bean pit, 5.31.5 high, low at 5.24.5, settlement price there at 5.25.5. They were down a penny and a quarter. And the August soybeans, 5.31.5 the high today, the low and the settlement price both at 5.27 in the July, or rather August soybeans for next year, and they were down 1 cent. December bean meal, $1.70 for the day. Had a high of 149.30, a low at 146.60. Settlement price at 148.70, and the January contract was up 90 cents at 149.60. December bean oil, 20.49, the high, the low at 20.10, settled 20.12. They were down 15, and the January was down 15 as well at 20.22. Now Celeste Quinn's here with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, let's begin with November feeder cattle. 107.60 the high, 107 even the low, 107.45 the settlement, that up a nickel. January feeders, 102.20 the high, 101.12.5 the low, 101.47.5 the settlement, that down 27.5. March, 99.02.5 the high, 98.15 the low, 98.55 the settlement, that down 45. December live cattle, 83.15 the high, 82.20 the low, 83.02.5 the settlement, that up 57.5. February, 86.50 the high, 85.40 the low, 86.45 the settlement, that up 62.5. December lean hog, 73.10 the high, 71.75 the low, 72.10 the settlement, that down 15. February, 72.70 the high, 71.30 the low, 72.30 the settlement, that up 70. April, the high 69.70, the low 67.50, the settlement 69.45, that up 155. May 68.25, the high, the low 67.15, the settlement 68.15, that up 72.5. February bellies 103.15, the high 101.10, the low 102.37.5, the settlement, that up 67.5. The Dow is up 11 points, the NASDAQ up 1, the S&P 500 a fraction lower.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Verde Gallery, featuring Dia de los Muertos, a celebration of art, music, words, and dance. Starts October 25th and runs through December 4th. Verde Gallery, a fine art gallery, cafe, and newsroom at 17 East Taylor, downtown Champaign. On the web at www.verdant-systems.com. Be inspired.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's Ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he